This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
For the Hidden Killers Podcast, I'm Stacey Cole. Corey Richens back in the spotlight, a Utah mother of three who published a children's book about grief after her husband's death, has been ordered to stand trial on charges of murder, attempted murder, and other crimes in relation to his death. Let's go now to the hearing.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. If the court would indulge me, just a couple minutes. I know you're so familiar with preliminary hearings. You do about a billion of them a year, probably. But I do just want to talk about what they are and what they mean to this system and to my client. So Utah is a state that has decided not to employ the grand jury system to determine whether someone should be prosecuted for a felony crime. Utah has decided to place the entire power of whether someone's going to be dragged away from their home in handcuffs to a courtroom facing serious charges to the discretion of these people at this table. It's their power to fill out an information.
I have some role in the process.
Yes. Before they get to you. I haven't got to that part yet.
Right.
You're jumping ahead.
Okay.
But what brings them to you is the people sitting right here. And it's their opinions. It's their beliefs. They're not a grand jury. They're prosecutors. They do their best. So what we have created to protect clients from that awesome power that sits at that table is this process of a gatekeeping, that instead of delegating that to a grand jury, people in our society that come together and close doors and hear the evidence and decide whether there's enough to put someone through this, they bring it to you. You're the gatekeeper. And this preliminary hearing is a critical right that every single individual who they decide to write a charge against has. And when we come before you, we recognize that it's a low standard. We recognize that probable cause means that. It just means enough to charge you. It doesn't mean enough to convict you. It doesn't mean enough to determine you committed a crime. It's enough to charge you. But that charging decision does matter. And it's going to have a huge, huge impact on the way this case plays out, on the evidence that is brought before the jury, on who will be witnesses, determining what charges get past this gate, you the gatekeeper. So we believe very, very, very strongly that the charge of attempted murder has not met the lowest standard even of probable cause. And that as rare as it is for a judge to say, there's not even enough to charge here, it is anticipated that that will happen on occasion, which is why you do thousands of these, right? Because every once in a while, they don't get up to that level. And we think in this case they haven't done it, and we'd like to tell you why. So thank you for indulging me in that.
I agree with everything you said about the law.
Okay.
What is the essential element of count two that you believe the state has either shown no evidence of or insufficient evidence to draw a reasonable inference regarding?
Causation. 100% causation. So, in order for them to establish an attempted murder,
right,
they have to show that Ms. Richens took some act that caused someone to be in danger of death, right? She had to have caused something that put them at risk,
right?
Whether they actually died, obviously, it's attempt, right? So, I think it's critical that you understand the timeline of that day. And I want to walk it through, and I know it may take us a couple of minutes, but I think it shows so clearly that they cannot make the connection. And it's indisputable evidence that's in the Cellebrite that has been downloaded off their phones. There's no debate about what happened on those phones, okay? So, in Exhibit 6, there are substances of text between Eric and Corey that say exactly their communications that day. I want to go back to the very beginning, which is the receipt, which is Exhibit 66 from the Mirror Lake Diner. It shows that Corey's credit card swiped at 9:07 a.m. and that she ordered a bagel breakfast sandwich
and an omelet.
There is a statement under the sandwich that it's over hard, which means it's an egg sandwich. There's an egg in that breakfast sandwich, and I think that's important because I don't know about you, but I'm not eating an egg sandwich 2 to 3 hours after it's brought to me. You eat it quick or you don't eat it. So she brings an egg sandwich home at 9:07. This actually hasn't come in, but I think the court could take judicial notice because of the address on Ms. Carrington's exhibit about the Willow Creek home where they resided. It's about 5 minutes away from this cafe, and I don't think the county attorney will dispute that. Nothing in Camas is very far away. So it's about a 5 minute drive from the cafe to their home. So best case scenario of her credit cards being swiped at 9:07, she's getting home around 9:15 in that area.
Is there any evidence that she actually went home?
Correct.
Well, I'm asking.
There is. On her phone, the printout of her phone shows her returning back to. Well, actually, they've introduced that exhibit that they blew up that showed that she was on her way to the house, and that's from her home.
Okay.
So she was at home. So there's a period of time where she's at home between 9:15 and 9:41 a.m. with eggs to eat. Now, it is a fair assumption that when you bring eggs home, you eat them quickly. So it is perfectly possible and just as inferential that she could have had breakfast with her husband that morning together. And let me tell you why I believe that that's proven in the state's own case. Because at no point in any conversations, any texts between Corey and Eric, does he ever tell her that he's feeling sick until he tells her at 11:40 something that if I'm still feeling this bad, I'm going to go to the hospital. So it sounds very much that they've already discussed that he doesn't feel well, right? So it is perfectly consistent with Corey Richens' statement to her friend, they breakfast together, which would make it pretty hard to poison someone when they're sitting there and you're handing them their food and watching you hand them their food. So then you have Eric between 10:21 and 12:06, and these are reflected in exhibit number 38, which shows the locations of calls made by Eric.
Could you pause for a second?
Yes.
Is there a statement that they ate breakfast together?
They just talked about her telling her friend lying that they were together when they ate.
So I just want to make sure I'm not missing anything that you're seeing. Quote, forgive me, folks. I didn't even make him a fucking sandwich, those fucking idiots. It was Valentine's Day, and Eric and I both were working from home that day, and I ordered lunch from Mirror Lake Diner.
Well, that was months later, and she hadn't seen the time. She hadn't been exposed to any of
Hey, folks, I need you to take a deep breath. Is there any evidence that she has a backward-looking statement saying, I ordered breakfast?
Well, that's the only statement that we're aware of.
Okay.
But at that point, she hadn't seen the time. So she's remembering if it was breakfast, lunch, whatever. I mean, that was months later.
Pardon.
But she admits she got it at Mirror Lake. She admits they ate it together. She makes up the time of breakfast and lunch. I mean, there's no debate that she was not there at lunchtime. That didn't happen. So,
right. So
that's clearly a mistake. So she leaves the house at 9:41 and is gone for the rest of the day. Eric drives to multiple other locations after she leaves.
Do we know, help me out, do we know that? Or
yes.
Was he doing the estimating from home? This was unclear to me from the testimony.
So in the Celebrate exhibit that is Eric's phone, it shows where he's making calls from.
Okay.
And so he makes calls from I think he goes to the, it looks like the Smith's grocery store or the Walmart. He goes and runs some errands. He's
right.
making business calls ever since Corey left, the whole time. After he's eaten the egg sandwich, he's driving around, he's making calls. Then he texts Corey at 11:27 and talks to her about some soccer fees that the boys owe. And then says a few minutes later, so between 11:27, he's talking about soccer, and 11:33, so he hasn't seen Corey now in 2 hours, he says, I'm going to go lay down. If I don't feel better, I may go to the hospital.
Right.
And I must respectfully point out that when the prosecution talked about her saying, go take a nap, and how that was chilling, he pulled that completely out of context of the rest of what she said in that text.
Do you need me to come home?
Would you like me to come home? Jesus, is that bad? You know, she even at one point later in the day talks about, he says, I wish you were here, and she's like, I would cuddle you. So that is very misleading to pull that statement out, and I need to correct that for the record. But regardless now, he hasn't been in her presence for 2 hours. If he ate that sandwich, he ate it around 9:30, give or take, at the latest. So in that period of time, he's been running errands, doing business calls, texting Corey, very benign, normal day-to-day texts, nothing about I'm about to die, nothing like that. He takes a nap for 2 hours. Then he gets up, they text romantic texts, wish you were here, like to cuddle. That's at 1:43 when he just woke up. The same period of time continues to make work calls from 1:50 to 2:30. Goes to a soccer game with his kids from 3:52 to 6:11. Takes the boys to get some food. Leaves food for Corey in his truck as they go back to the game because Corey is running late. And that's the day. That's the day that they are now saying that that you can infer she tried to murder her husband. There's no evidence he ever took a pill from her. There's no evidence that she ever, if she put fentanyl in his egg sandwich at 9:30 and he ate it, he would not be okay for 2 more hours. He would not be. And there's zero evidence. There's not one piece of evidence from Eric himself that he ever took anything from Corey that day, that he felt bad up until 11:33 is the first time he feels bad. Now, I think you asked a fascinating question when you asked the prosecutor, do I need to consider the death as support for probable cause of February 14th, looking backwards? And I think that's a really important inquiry, because obviously, if you look backwards, everything you're looking backwards at shades how you look at something that happened before. But if you look at that count in isolation, there is no evidence that supports an opportunity for her. There's no evidence to support that he took anything. There's no evidence to support that he had fentanyl, OxyContin. And as a matter of fact, he told...
Can I ask you some specific questions about this?
Yes.
So let's take it one piece at a time here in terms of events after February 14th.
Yes.
In your view, can the court consider Ms. Richens' text messages to Mr. Grossman on February 15th? Can I consider them at all?
Can you consider them? I mean, I think you can consider anything you want to consider in terms of...
Well, see, that's the question. The Utah Rules of Evidence say, no, there's all kinds of stuff you can't consider under any set of circumstances, and it's often a difficult slalom course to ski. We did some of this yesterday morning, trying to get a sense from the defense of whether or not the court can consider things like... Deus Ex Machina, quote, if he would just go away, end quote.
So,
as evidence of an inference that she wanted him not around anymore.
But that could be divorce. That doesn't have to be death.
And we're not in a trial, and I'm not a jury, and so I have to contend with black letter law. Let me just get this out. I really am genuinely interested in your response. I acknowledge there are multiple credible inferences that can be drawn from this evidence. Several of them innocent, but I'm not allowed to pick and choose. I am not allowed to weigh the relative reasonableness or credibility of the inferences. I'm required to draw all reasonable inferences in the state's favor, to view the evidence as a whole in the state's favor, and identify, is there a reading of the evidence that supports a reasonable belief? And so when you say things like, look, this evidence, she went home, I imagine Mr. Bloodworth is fighting the urge to jump up and say, and that just shows she went home to give her this hand.
No, I lost your sandwich.
That just shows he went home to give her the sandwich. She went home to give her the sandwich. And so the reason I ask about the stuff afterwards,
right. The
text messages, her statement regarding ordering a lunch, being home together.
So the text message certainly could be considered for the death, right? Because he's still alive.
Well,
and
I got
it's
that.
February 15th.
But that's not my question.
Right? So how does the statement on the 15th relate to something that didn't happen? She's talking about it in the future, right? Like,
I guess the question is, if on February 15th she has a text message showing a desire to have him not around anymore, why can't I consider that for her mental state on the 14th?
She doesn't say you should be dead.
I know, but we're talking in terms of reasonable inferences here.
It's, you know, criminal defense lawyers look at these phones, and it's pretty terrifying to think that someone's going to go back and look at texts that you wrote about your spouse, you know, years later, and put it all into a cone of literal death threats. When you say, I wish he'd leave, he's getting on my nerves, I want to leave the house, I'm going to leave him, I want to divorce him. Eric, they put in Eric's divorce meeting with his divorce lawyer. I mean, this was not a perfect couple. They didn't have a perfect relationship. But to take a context, one single text, and to say that that gives you a reasonable belief that she tried to kill him the day before, I don't see the connection at all.
Okay.
I don't. I don't think that is a connection.
So I hear you saying you can consider a judge, but it doesn't have any weight.
I don't think it does.
Okay. Same response regarding her June 18, 2022 text to her friend?
That's what we just said, where she has not seen yet the time. Like, she hadn't had an opportunity to review the timing. So if she messed up lunch and breakfast, but everything else in there is consistent with what happened that day.
What about her text message on or about February 26th to Carmen Lauber saying, I need something stronger?
Again, that's after the 14th.
It's a backward-looking statement, though, or at least it's comparative.
Well, apparently she had recently picked, apparently according to Ms. Lauber, she had just recently got something from her. So,
right.
I mean, that could be not connected to the 14th at all.
Okay.
So,
or more specifically, not necessarily referring to what she got on the 11th,
right.
But could be from the 25th.
But I mean, you have a claim that Mr. Richens was poisoned on the 14th. There is no medical evidence. There is no connection. There is no causation. There is nothing but pure speculation that because they believe she tried to kill him and successfully killed him in March, that must mean she tried it before. That is not enough to reach a reasonable belief that someone, and that's the question you asked at the very beginning.
Right.
Just because, I mean, it's like a backwards acting in conformity argument.
Yes.
It's a backwards 404B evidence.
Well, this is my question.
Right.
Does that exist?
Which, by the way, 404B's whole purpose of existing in every state in America and in the federal system is exactly to avoid this kind of prejudicial leap of because somebody did something once, they must have done it again. That's the whole reason we have 404B, is to prevent that.
I acknowledge that. I imagine you would acknowledge as well the numerous exceptions and the lengthy or the deep body of case law regarding exceptions to the general bar to propensity evidence. And so here, when Mr. Bloodworth makes references to modus operandi, he's arguing to some of those exceptions.
Well,
in your view, does 404B work backwards as well, or does it only work prospectively?
It only works prospectively, in my opinion. But the analogy as to why this is such damaging and risky analysis can be found in that rule, baked into that rule that our legislatures and our Supreme Court recognized that that's very, very dangerous to base the prosecution on somebody, well, somebody used drugs once before in their life, they're probably guilty this time. That's the whole thing we're trying to avoid in our system. And that's the whole basis for their argument on the attempt. That's the entire basis, because they know they don't have proof. They don't have medical proof. We heard testimony about allergies. We heard about all of that. So, I mean, there's innocent explanations for everything that happened on the 14th, every single thing. So that doesn't lead to a reasonable belief they are 100% relying on an action in conformity argument.
I don't think we heard the admissible testimony of allergies, but I take your point.
I'm sorry. I'm trying really hard to separate it in my brain.
I understand.
I actually think it's included in the... I believe it's included in some of the exhibits, but we'll just leave it alone just in case I'm wrong about that. I can check that while he's back up. But having said all of that, you know, the distribution charge that is connected to the attempt charge, if the attempt charge doesn't have probable cause, the distribution charge doesn't have probable cause.
I agree.
They both have to go.
May I ask you about the consciousness of guilt argument that the state makes?
Yes.
Which I understand to be my words, not the state's. Why is she lying in her text message to her best friend in June about what happened on the 14th?
I think the only thing she got wrong was breakfast for lunch.
Well, I think her location about her being home all day is one of the things they lean on. We were working from home that day.
I mean, that's easily provable. So it's not like when she's talking to her friend, she's trying to remember the day back, you know, a few months later. And she got part of it right, I mean, and part of it wrong. And I just don't know if it's just, I mean, how do we know that, what purpose would that be? How would that serve as a lie?
Well, the argument is that she's hiding the fact that she was with another person besides her husband on that day.
Okay, that's a good reason to lie. Because you're with your boyfriend, and you don't want to admit you're with your boyfriend.
Right.
I mean, that's not conscious of guilt of killing your husband. That's not wanting to tell people you were hanging out with your boyfriend.
Okay. That's one credible inference, right?
Yes.
All right. Would you say that it's not a credible inference that the reason she's lying to her friend is because she had the scheme to be not present?
But she admitted she was present with him, and she was. She brought him breakfast.
Okay.
So that's true. That inculpates her more than exculpates her. That's the opposite of covering herself. She's putting herself in the house with him on the day that they're claiming he was attempted to be poisoned. That's a statement against interest.
Okay.
In my opinion. So, I don't really need to argue the distribution. You get that. All right. So, the only other question, the only other things that we have on the fraud type arguments, I do think that the state never established jurisdiction or venue for any of those counts. I don't believe we've heard any proof about why this court has jurisdiction over these acts. They did not establish where they occurred.
Why isn't there a reasonable inference that Corey Richens was making these applications and forming these schemes from Summit County?
And they have to show that. You can't just out of whole cloth make that up. There's no evidence that that occurred.
Well, the standard of proof is the same for every element of the crime, right?
But there's no evidence that was submitted.
She lives here. Her business was based here. I think there's a basis for reasonable belief that she was initiating these contacts, forming these schemes from Summit County.
Well, I just want to make the record. Okay. I don't believe they've established jurisdiction or venue on any of those counts. Furthermore, on the... I don't see why the two insurance fraud counts don't merge here.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm seeing several merger issues in this information, but merger is a fact issue that's handled after conviction. Am I right about that? Not at a preliminary hearing.
You said after conviction? You meant after.
Is it before submitting it to the jury or after?
Merger?
Yeah.
I always do as a pretrial motion, but
okay.
I may be wrong. Maybe two of you are wrong.
I don't think it gets considered, though, at a preliminary hearing as a matter of law.
Well, I think if you determine at a preliminary hearing that two counts are actually one act, that you cannot push forward one of them. Absolutely, I think you can do that. But
do you have a citation for that? I thought it was the opposite at a preliminary hearing.
Well, I think you would just argue that they can't make two separate counts. So there's not sufficient reason to believe that a second crime is committed because it's all one. So that's your finding, that it's a reason. You can't reasonably believe the second crime is committed because it's just one crime. Because the scheme swallows the allegation of the filling out of the application. I mean, it swallows it. So,
I'll take a look at this.
Yeah. And then I think on the rest, we would just submit on the other counts, Your Honor.
All right, so let's just be clear. To the extent that merger needs to be considered as part of the probable cause determination, that's going to mean that 1 and 3 merge, right?
Yes.
2 and 4 merge.
No, not 1 and 3. Attempted murder is on a separate day. It wouldn't.
1 and 3, 2 and 4.
I'm sorry, let me look at what 1 and 3 is. I'm getting my numbers mixed up.
So the distribution counts merge into the ag murder and ag attempt, right?
No, those would be two separate crimes.
Tell me why. You can't commit them without doing the distribution, right?
Right. I think they don't merge, though. They're separate crimes. Like, distribution is a separate offense than the attempted murder.
Okay.
So
then
merge.
Why isn't, on the one hand, forging a signature, and on the other hand, making a false statement when trying to collect on the claim, why aren't those two separate crimes? What is the merger
because
you're arguing for?
The two insurance fraud charges, because that is the same offense. Insurance fraud is not two separate offenses. And what they did is they said she created a scheme to wrongfully get insurance fraud. And part of that scheme was she signed the application and they just charged insurance fraud twice. I'm not talking about the forgery, I'm talking about the two insurance fraud charges. I think they merged.
And just to be clear, you think they merge because it is the same fruit of the criminal conduct? That is, there was only one policy.
Right. That's correct.
Okay, I understand.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can I just have 1 minute before I sit?
Of course.
Last thing I would say too is there's so many reasons that Mr. Richens could have not felt well that day and taken a nap. And to get over the hump of saying you're going to stand trial for attempted aggravated murder, which is about the next to most serious charge you can ever be charged with, because he went to take a nap, is pushing it, Your Honor. We're just asking that the court exercise your gatekeeping function. Let's remove that from the confusion it will cause the jury, the prejudice it will cause the jury, the complete lack of foundation. we're asking that the court take the rarest of steps and say, this one will not go forward. And we submit on that.
Okay, thanks, Dean. Thank you. Mr. Blow.
Your Honor, real quick on just the merger issue, it's two different policies. Count 7 relates to the $250,000 two-stage policy. Count 8, I think, relates to the $100,000 policy.
That's not the way it is charged. I think that is, you're going to need to amend the information if you want to do that. And frankly, I don't think there's any allegation of fraud, or there's any, tell me why there's a any reasonable belief regarding fraud related to $250,000 policy.
Fraud in the claim, saying that I don't know why Eric Richards.
That's not what she said with respect to the $250,000 claim. That was only with respect to the $100,000 claim. It's two separate diaries. This is why I'm asking.
Your Honor, I think in...
they were paid out at different times.
Sure, in the one diary, though, they discussed both policies.
I don't think that's true. You can show me, but I looked at them carefully yesterday. They have separate diaries regarding separate policies.
Let me ask you this, sir. Is this an issue you're considering, and so I can show it to you, but I don't know that it's a...
I understood you to be saying Count 7 is based upon statements made during the process of collecting the proceeds in June. Count 8 is the scheme to get the policy with intent to kill Eric Richards to collect.
So this one is the call log for 2022 policy. This is the call log for 2017 policy, which there's 150, 100. There's the scheme.
Are you referring to the statement, Mr. Burmester, of no known drugs, occasional cannabis use?
No, that...
That came out of the medical records.
Your Honor, it's Exhibit 18, page 1. It's the last note.
Respect to the $250,000 policy. Got it. Thank you for that clarification.
Your Honor, regarding the 404B discussion, the purpose of admitting the evidence is further to many of the exceptions, propensity, intent, preparation, lack of accident, nearly all of them. 404B just relates to whether or not the defendant acts in conformity with her character. Whether that's prospectively or retrospectively is irrelevant. The most of the defense's argument against bind over the attempted homicide count. As the court kind of noted, a lot of that goes to the jury. A lot of that was arguing countervailing evidence. As the court is well aware, the standard today is notwithstanding countervailing evidence, whether that's countervailing evidence of how quickly Eric Richens eats his eggs, or whether he was shot beforehand or afterhand. it's countervailing evidence. It does not apply to the court's analysis today. Part of that countervailing evidence, I find it ironic that counsel argued we hadn't heard one piece of evidence from Eric Richens. What questions does the court have?
I understand the state's position. I understand you to be saying conduct in March is evidence of other acts admissible to prove an MO. I understand the state's position.
And the lessons learned, I think, is very important.
Sure.
You know, Your Honor, we've had some discussion with defense counsel also as it relates to the standards at issue for the probable cause determination. And I think the court has sufficient evidence when viewed in the light most favorable to the state, when giving the state all the reasonable inferences, notwithstanding the countervailing evidence, to find probable cause here even without the 404B part. The 404B part helps, certainly. But I don't even think it's necessary for the court to get to a probable cause determination. And, you know, Schmidt, in discussing probable cause, references that, you know, probable cause in a preliminary hearing is the same as probable cause for an arrest warrant. And if the state were to set forth all the evidence it has put, referenced in its brief, argued here today, and charge an attempted murder, and ask for an arrest warrant on the information.
Or a search warrant.
Or a search warrant.
Right.
And if the state submitted it to 100 judges in Utah, 100 of them would issue that warrant.
Check to speculation.
It's an argument. Over. I understand the state's point. Okay. It is 11:29. We're going to come back at 11:50. Oh, Ms. Nestor, my apologies.
Quickly, I checked the ME report. It did reference the fact that he was positive for COVID, but okay. It did not talk about allergies in the ME report. That's where I thought it might be. But I'll keep looking and see if I can find it. But I do know that he was did test positive for COVID.
Understood. Thank you. 11:50, court's in recess. Thank you.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.